The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they're easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start by a plan for 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Good morning, I should say, California time. Welcome to our Friday morning Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston, and thank you very much for tuning in. We have a very exciting show today. I'll describe it in just a minute. First, a couple of quick announcements. For today, we're on a full Space Show format of 90 minutes. And remember, we are a talk show, so we definitely prefer your phone calls over emails, and that is 1-866-687-7223. But if you do need to email us, you can always do so at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. So again, full 90-minute program. And on Sunday, let me just briefly tell you that Dr. Tom Spilker is with us. So he's also at JPL, but he's with us in his capacity as the chief engineer and architect for the Gateway Foundation and Orbital Construction. And they've just had a beginning of their company. Many of you probably got to watch it on their web presentation. And he's going to be with us talking a little bit of a different perspective than some of the other people from Gateway have been talking about. So that is on Sunday. Then for the following week, there will be no Tuesday Space Show, no Hotel Mars, and no Friday Space Show due to my being waylaid with eye medical problems and surgery. I will come back, and we will be live on Sunday, February 14th, Valentine's Day, with Kurt Homer. And you can see more about Kurt. He's actually one of my graduate students way back when I was teaching at the University of North Dakota Space Studies Department. But all of this will be in the website newsletter and the newsletter that I prepare over the weekend. But do note there will be no programming on Tuesday, no Hotel Mars on Wednesday, and no Friday program on February 12th. We resume our live broadcast on February 14th, Sunday. And so back for today, our toll-free number again, 1-866-687-7223. Our website is up, and our newsletter on the website is current. You can check it out. It's in the upper right corner of our homepage, but it will be updated tomorrow, and then you'll have the website newsletter going forward. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or quickly download programs. And they're also podcasted, and we're in most common podcast client services. Also, the archives on our website are compressed MP3s. And if you have any difficulty listening to any of the formats of our programs, including live shows like today, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We also have a Space Show logo wear store. Check it out. And if you want T-shirts, sweatshirts, things like that, iPhone covers, you'll find them there. And click on any of the pictures of Pepper listening to the Space Show, and she will take you to our Cafe Press logo wear store. Upper left on our homepage, you'll find a menu button called Listen Live. So this tells you how to listen to the live broadcast like we're doing now, archived MP3s on our website, and then the podcast format. If you have any questions, as I said, please do email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. One of the most important parts of our website, to me probably the most important part, is the fact that we are a listener-supported radio program, and we are a nonprofit 501c3. Our parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and we do these great broadcasts with wonderful guests like we have today, and I'll introduce in just a minute, because many of you do financially help out and support the Space Show. And we definitely appreciate that. So if you are a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a tax deduction for your nonprofit gift. And the same is true for those of you who pay California taxes. We're a public benefit corporation in California. And we need your support, and we appreciate it, and pass the word. And then we also do have sponsors. I'll talk more about that when we take a break, since today is a full 90-minute Space Show program. But we couldn't be doing this show without the great support of our sponsors. So let me tell you about our guest today. So we are most fortunate to have back with us, and hopefully I'll pronounce his name correctly, Dr. Pekka Janhunen. Did I get it right? I hope so.
Yes.
He is with the Finnish Meteorological Institute in Helsinki, also Aurora Propulsion Technology, and more. You can read his full bio. It is up on the website. But he wrote a very interesting paper that listener John Jossi, you know him as Fremont John, sent me a couple of weeks ago, Terraforming the Dwarf Planet, Interconnected and Growable Series Mega Satellite World. And when you start out reading his abstract, it says, we analyzed a mega satellite settlement built from Sirius material in high Sirius orbit. And Sirius is selected because it has nitrogen, which is necessary for an Earth-like atmosphere. I will link to his paper in the summary and also on the blog. Pekka, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you? And it's good to have you back on board with us.
Yes, thank you, David. I'm fine, and I'm also very honored and glad to be back in this show, of which I have very good memories from last year.
Well, we do too. And in fact, when John sent me your paper, his quote was, it's time to get Pekka back on the program. So that the listeners speak highly of your first visit, and we all welcome you back, and we're excited to talk to you. How did you come up with a concept to have a satellite a settlement on Sirius, and what do you mean by a mega satellite world?
Yes, so it's a long story. Basically, it was a long path of research and blind alleys of research and so on. Basically, I wrote down the requirements, what I consider that people would like to have a very good life in space, I mean, in an extraterrestrial environment. And then I noticed that this old concept by Gerald O'Neill, these O'Neill cylinders, they almost satisfy, or they could be made to satisfy almost all the requirements, but not quite. And then I kind of wanted to ask myself the question that how can we fix those shortcomings? And then because basically this concept is just a bunch of O'Neill cylinders installed and put together and attached to a common rigid frame. And then why it could be anywhere in the solar system, but I selected Sirius specifically because Sirius has nitrogen. So Sirius was not the first celestial body that I considered, so I first tried almost everything else. So in one phase I had this concept formulated for some C-type asteroid, which is 100 kilometers across. But then when I realized that one could actually use the space elevator rather easily on Ceres, then I thought that, okay, so the gravity of Ceres is not such a big problem, so why not go there directly? And it has all the nitrogen as well, and it has plenty of resources, so they don't run out.
But it's a long ways out there, so how do you get there if you're going to have a human settlement? That would probably seem to be a huge problem given today's technology, right?
That's a huge problem, of course, here. Yes, that is true. It's not an insurmountable problem. So there has been a spacecraft already going there. I mean the Dawn mission.
Right.
But I mean, okay, of course, taking humans there is a huge step, because it's about. Well, it's kind of hard to measure these distances in space but let's say roughly speaking, two times farther away than Mars. I mean, it's hard because if you don't, the direct actual distance doesn't make much sense because we have to consider these orbits and how things orbit the sun all the time. But roughly speaking, two times farther away than Mars. However, there would also be a possibility to test this concept in a little bit easier way by using one of the moons of Mars. So one could build this kind of mega satellite also in high orbit of Mars and taking resources from Deimos moon specifically, or maybe Phobos also, but Deimos is so better in this case, more suitable in this case. But that can't be the final. I mean because Deimos is a relatively small body, so it doesn't have resources for the far future expansion of mankind, but Ceres certainly has.
So
and because this is a scientific paper, I wanted to concentrate on Ceres in this work because this is kind of the long term prospect.
So when you refer to mega satellite settlement, you're referring to many O'Neillian like cylinders connected together in orbit around Ceres, correct?
Yes, that's quite correct, yes.
Okay.
And I first considered, like, formation flying of O'Neill cylinders, but I couldn't kind of make them to work. I mean, I kind of tended to run into various issues with that concept, and then I thought that, okay, why just not make a rigid frame? It's a huge frame, of course, but because it's in microgravity, it's not... the mass that you use in building that frame is only a very minor fraction of the total mass of these cylinders, because most of the mass goes into the radiation shields anyway.
I already have a listener question for you.
Okay, that's interesting.
Our email listener, Todd, in San Diego, says the first question I would ask is, given that right now we only have chemical propulsion, is it even feasible to get humans out to a settlement in or around Ceres? If not, what kind of propulsion would we need? Would nuclear be okay, or do we need something even better than that? What do you think the time from Earth to Ceres would be if we had nuclear propulsion?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think that chemical works. I didn't do the orbital calculations quite accurately, but I used some approximation, and it seemed to me that if you tank Starship fully in high elliptic orbit, then you could get a very rather nice payload of order of 100 tons to Ceres surface just by using the chemical propulsion. But I would think that electric propulsion would be quite useful for going to Ceres because Ceres has low gravity, so one can't really use this so-called Oberth effect for braking the spacecraft upon entering Ceres. So the electric propulsion would be kind of suitable. And the Dawn mission that went to Ceres already used electric propulsion. So the question is just that which propellant. So the present propellant, which is xenon, is certainly too expensive. So so one needs something cheaper. So I would think that one should maybe do some work in trying to qualify electric propulsion, some electric propulsion thrusters using water, because water would be a good, cheap propellant, and it's also available on Ceres in plentiful amounts. So one could also combine that with sort of asteroid mining, if one wants to contribute to the economic aspect of this concept. So water-based electric propulsion would be kind of something which has a very good chance of working, in my opinion, because already now we know that oxygen is a possible propellant for Hall thrusters, and at least Hall thrusters, because that has been shown by the Italians already for a different application. But and water and oxygen are relatively similar from the chemical point of view when you ionize them. So both are highly oxidizing species. So both are very challenging to work with in the plasma stage. But since it works with oxygen, then why wouldn't it work with water either? And even if not, then there is always the option of having water on board and then electrolyzing it, and then maybe throw out the hydrogen and then use the oxygen as electric propulsion propellant. So that would be kind of a fallback solution in that case. So then we would already now know that these chemicals work.
But for the crew that's going out there, I don't remember how long it took to get to Ceres, and it had a detour to Vega, as I remember, or Vegas or something like that, as I recall.
Yes, it takes rather long time. So with Hohmann transfer, it takes, I don't remember exactly, but more than 1 year anyway, but less than 1.5 years, so in that range. So let's say 15 months, for example, 15 months. And that's a long time. But with electric propulsion, you could try and make it shorter. Maybe not now, but I mean in the future. And then, I mean, the radiation dose is the problem, is the issue with manned spaceflight in this case. But if the propellant would be water, then one could use the water as a... I mean, one could store it around the manned capsule and use it as a radiation shield during the journey to some extent. So that's one thing which helps. I mean, it's much harder to do that with chemical propulsion, because the propellant is cryogenic, so it's kind of hard to store it around the manned capsule, but manned compartment, but... If one uses electric propulsion and water, then that part becomes easier.
Aside from nitrogen and oxygen, why would one want to go as far as Ceres for O'Neillian colonies or a space settlement? Wouldn't they rather do it, say, in our solar system and closer in, or is Ceres such a much better place?
Well, one has to consider what would be the alternative. So one has to get small body material. So asteroids. So there are some near Earth asteroids, of course, which are closer, but they are rather small. They are small in size. So there is not so much material in them. And also, there is the drawback that their orbits are rather eccentric, I mean elliptic orbits, and that's kind of inconvenient for this settlement. So if the settlement is in a highly eccentric orbit, then the thermal design is kind of challenging. Then the moons of Mars, which I already mentioned, they are certainly an option, and actually the moons of Mars are the biggest, I mean, they are the most nearby small bodies of their size class, basically. So all the asteroids which are closer to Earth than the Martian moons are also smaller than the Martian moons. So that the Martian moons are kind of the most accessible bodies of their size class. But they are not sufficient for really large expansion of the human population. So they are sufficient for a few tens of millions of people, but not more. So if one wants to go to the billion range in the future, then one needs something bigger. So one needs something which is at least about 100 kilometer sized body. And there are many of those in the asteroid belt, but they are actually almost as far as Ceres itself. So if one wants to have billion scale population, then Ceres, there is nothing fundamentally closer than Ceres in that case. Plus that one gets the nitrogen problem solved at the same time.
What do they do with Ceres once they have the the colonies orbiting and they're up there? Do they go down to the surface? Do they establish mining? Do they have any kind of industry that they create that can help make them self-sustaining? Because they're going to be pretty far out there from Earth to be dependent upon Earth.
Yes. Oh, okay. So, well, of course, in all endeavors, all plans of this sort, the ultimate goal is to have a fully self-sufficient population, of course.
Right. So
it depends on the phase of the project, that how much, what is the fraction of material that must be imported from Earth versus how much can be produced locally. So in case of Ceres, I mean, the radiation shields and the soil, they are about 95% of the mass of the settlement. So they can be lifted from Ceres using the space elevator. Or if one doesn't like the space elevator, then one can just use ordinary rocketry. But in that case, I mean, reusable rockets. But in that case, one should make the propellants on the surface of Ceres from the local water and carbon containing minerals. And I just think that the space elevator in the case of Ceres might be simpler, technically simpler than those propellant factories. And also it's energetically much, it uses much less energy per kilogram of mass lifted from the surface of Ceres. So I would assume that the people wouldn't go to the surface of Ceres because I mean, there is no reason for them to do it. So, and in any case, the first phase of this project should be done robotically without people. I mean, this is my starting point. That is my starting point anyway. So that the first habitat would be built robotically, almost completely ready before the first crew goes in. And in that case, either only the radiation shields and the soil material would be taken from Ceres, so that's the 95% of the mass. Or if we are lucky, we might already have a steel factory, robotic steel factory orbiting Ceres, which would make the structural parts of the settlement, which is about 4% of the mass. So, and then the remaining 1% is mostly nitrogen and oxygen and water. So if all that is done by local resources, and that basically only means that the steel production, then one gets more than 99% of the mass from local resources. And then, of course, when time goes on, then one, more and more of the materials would be made from local resources.
Do you think that? Well, I guess what I'm trying to find out is there in the business sense, I would say, is there market demand for this kind of mega satellite settlement system? Would you have people wanting to do it? Is this more or less a government research project, or is this actually a commercial type of settlement that eventually will be self-sustaining?
I mean, currently, this is just scientific research, so it's just one paper written by one scientist. So it could be any of these, but I mean, I don't think it's impossible that it could have a business case. And I have gotten some contacts regarding that matter also. So in that case, I mean, the funding would go something like that the first settlers would take a bank loan and then fund the initial development by that, and then they would move there, and once there, they would be in a good vantage point of teleoperating the robotics at close distance to make this industry more efficient than what is possible to do remotely from Earth. And they would produce more of those settlements for newcomers, for new settlers who would arrive later. And then they would, of course, because it would be their construction, they would sell those living spaces to the newcomers, and they would get the funding from them. So this might sound like a Ponzi scheme, but I mean, of course, it's not a Ponzi scheme because actually those all people get the place where they can live in that case. So but anyway, it means that it could grow exponentially by in the financial sense by using this kind of approach.
It would take a pretty adventuresome person to want to do that. I think even wanting to go and live on the moon or live on Mars might be a push for a lot of people, but this seems, you know, a couple of grades steeper into something or other to want to go so far away, because you're not going to get back very easily or very often, are you?
Yeah, that's true, of course. But one has to remember that the moon is not a very healthy place to live because it has only 1/6 of Earth's gravity. So it's not good for the health of muscles and bones to be there for a longer time. So certainly not for a lifetime. And the same, unfortunately, I think, applies to Mars as well.
So
it's gravity.
So your cylinders are spinning at 1G, I take it, correct?
Yes, 1G, yes. So this is the starting point of the whole thing. And that was the starting point of the original Gerald O'Neill thinking also. So how to get 1G outside Earth, basically. And the cylinder is an answer to that question.
Listeners, let me again give out our program contact information for you. If you would like to call us, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And email, of course, drspace, drspace, @thespaceshow.com. You can also post comments on our blog. To do that, you go to our website, thespaceshow.com, all the way to the far right for the upcoming show menu, and open this program up. It is the first one listed with our guest today. And then, as with most blogs, you just simply scroll down to the bottom, and you'll see a place for posting a comment or asking a question. And as soon as you do that, I can receive a copy of it and can integrate it into the program. But again, our toll-free number, which is available, 866-687-7223. And email, once again, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Sandra is in Seattle, and she said, is there anything close by to Syria where people in these colonies or in this settlement could go for adventuresome visits or something? Or are you really just there and this is it, nothing else?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. So of course you could go to the surface of Ceres. I mean, nothing prohibits that. So I mean, because the gravity of Ceres is quite rather low, so the escape velocity is about 0.5 kilometer per second from Ceres. So for this kind of entertainment purpose, certainly, if people like it, certainly it could be arranged. One could arrange trips to the surface of Ceres. I mean, on the surface there is, 30 times less of gravity than on Earth, so it's pretty unique experience probably being there, because one can jump very high and stuff like that. So I haven't really thought about this, but this is a good idea, and we have to keep in mind that this kind of entertainment is important. Of course, in those cylinders, this reduced gravity entertainment is possible and easy. I mean, near the cylinder axis, you can have zero gravity recreational areas, and you can have floors where you have exactly Mars gravity, and another floor where you have exactly lunar gravity, and so on. So that kind of thing costs basically nothing and can be added to this thing. And of course, I mean, thinking of how close how it would feel to live in that settlement, I think it strongly depends on the size of the population that is up there. So if it's only small population, then it may feel crowded and so on. But if there are tens of thousands of people or hundreds of thousands of people around, then I mean, it might be kind of self-sustaining also psychologically. So we of course need psychological self-sustainability also, not only in terms of material resource, as soon as the population is large enough, I think.
Another email is Doug in Tucson, Arizona, and he says, given where we are today at the start of 2021, what is our, and I don't just mean NASA, but all of us here on Earth, what is our technological readiness level, or TRL, to do any part of this mission? If we really wanted to do it, when do you think it would be technically feasible for us to do it?
Yes. We could compare this with Elon Musk's plans of colonizing Mars. So I would think that this is roughly of the same level of difficulty as colonizing Mars. So in some respects this is easier than Mars, and in some respects this is more difficult. So this is easier than Mars because you don't need planetary landing, you don't have dust storms, you don't have nighttime, you don't have winter. But it's more difficult than Mars because this is farther, because the distance is larger, about two times larger, so the travel time is longer. And then, I mean, to the question that when this could happen, I mean, of course it's difficult to predict the future, but I mean, my kind of just personal opinion is that if people would really start to do this with vigorously, putting rather large resources to this kind of thing, then I would think that within the next 15 years, the very first people could move in.
Boy, I'd like to know the people who would want to go out there and do this. Maybe they'd be equivalent to people in the early periods of exploration or sailing the ocean to look for something else. Maybe they'd have to have the same kind of adventuresome spirit and risk-taking, I would imagine.
Yes, I don't know how many people have volunteered to be settlers of Mars. So one has to compare it to that one. So, but I assume that there are volunteers even also do that. So
well, there are.
I'm not an expert of that subject. I haven't researched it.
I think the closest thing to an actual count, although I'm sure maybe Musk has some counts, was when the Mars mission out of Holland wanted to have a settlement. They ultimately went bankrupt, and they had hundreds of thousands of people from around the world signing up, you know, with their video applications and things like that to go there. Now, whether they would have all gone or not is another question, but they certainly had, I think it was like 300,000 respondents with video applications. So there are people that at least on the early stages say they want to do this. Maybe, you know, it gets smaller as you start to get closer to launch date. But why do we need this particular offer of settlement, or for that matter, any offer of settlement? Or are they just for fun or for our entertainment, and we don't really need them? We could be just fine and dandy without them.
Of course, there can be many reasons for building these. The reasons can probably vary for different people. So, of course, for some people, it might be just fun. So, and that's perfectly acceptable. Why we need settlements of Earth settlements? When I think of the evolution of mankind, I think that there are two main motivations. The first motivation is that on Earth we are actually stressed by something which we hardly notice, and that's recurrent natural disasters. So in space, it's like it has the potential to be like living in southern Florida but without hurricanes, basically, or living in northern California but without wildfires, without earthquake risk, and all kinds of that thing. So in many places on Earth, we have our share of the risk of natural disasters of various types. In many regions, it's earthquake. In other regions, it's volcano. Yet another region is the tropical storms or wildfires or forest fires. And basically, if given the opportunity to get rid of all these at one go, then I think this is it's a relevant thing to consider. And the second thing is just economic expansion. So Earth is limited, but the solar system is much larger potentially. These kind of settlements could eventually contain much larger area of living than Earth's surface, and the human population could be like much larger in principle. It could be hundreds of billions. Or even trillions at the end, but of course it's a completely other question if it's wise to reproduce that much ever. So what is the peak? What is the maximum population that we actually want for ourselves? So that's a completely different question. But at least it's a property of life, and we are part of life. We are a living species first and foremost. So it's a basic property of life to extend its territory, to expand to new environments. And the economic, in the financial world, in case of people, the tendency of our financial economy, our fiscal economy to grow is a reflection of this evolutionary driving force to expand and to expand in all senses of the world.
If we compare space settlement and going out to Ceres, I don't know if governments will have a lot to say yes or no one way or another. I really have no clue. But is in your opinion, is one of them maybe a better chance to happen? And here I'm thinking Ceres might be better because there are people, I hear from them all the time, Pekka, that don't want humans on Mars because they think they're going to mess up all the scientific research. You probably hear it too. So and they talk about planetary protection and Article 9 of the Outer Space Treaty with all our countries have signed.
Yeah.
But that Ceres isn't part of any of that. So does
that's true.
So does Ceres become politically more feasible and therefore maybe more doable than Mars, or is the Mars resistance sort of insignificant? Musk probably thinks it's insignificant, but he will need a launch license, and that's the ultimate weapon of control. Is do you get a launch license or not? Right.
Yes.
What do you think? So go ahead.
Very good question. Yes, this is a very good question. So I want to make two points here. The first one is scientific, and the second one is mythological. So the scientific point is that, and it is not often said, but I think that that Mars is scientifically extremely valuable in the future, might be extremely valuable in the future, or might turn out to be very valuable in the future, because, not because there is life there, okay, there could be life in principle, but I don't give high chances to it. But what Mars almost certainly has, it has old meteorites from Earth, which have been preserved very well on the surface in the cold and dry conditions. And those meteorites, once we find them, of course they are difficult to find, but once we find them, they might contain completely unique, scientifically enormously valuable, well-preserved fossils of primitive life on Earth. I mean, billions of years of old algae, for example, algae cells, which have their biomolecules still more or less intact. So that is something which might be possible to find on Mars, and it's almost impossible to find it anywhere else in this universe, because the other body, close body, which is Moon, it can't do this kind of thing, this preservation, because it doesn't have atmosphere. So when this kind of this Earth meteorite collides with Moon, it just explodes into thousands of small pieces, and those pieces, of course, if they might have those biomolecules, but because they are small pieces, the space radiation penetrates into them and destroys those molecules. But on Mars, you might have a few meter scale meteorites in principle, whose center has been rather well protected against radiation for billions of years. So that's one argument for like keeping Mars. I mean, at least to be aware that there can be scientific treasures on the dry plains of Mars. Of course, this doesn't mean that it would be forbidden to go there, because it does mean that think twice before terraforming Mars, because if you start to warm up the climate of Mars, then that is almost certain to destroy this kind of specimens, because once the temperature rises and once there is humidity, then those old biomolecules will certainly be destroyed. Okay, so that was my speech on Mars. But then the other point is that, okay, Ceres has no mythological baggage with it. So because it can't be seen by the naked eye. So Ceres was found only 1801 by some Italian astronomer whose name I have forgotten. So Ceres has, we have been aware of the existence of Ceres only for 220 years, and so Ceres is not a divine heavenly body in any of the world religions for that reason. So nobody can. There are less mythological strings attached to Ceres than of the traditional planets which are known in astrology and religion.
So it's easier to go from that perspective. May not be easier to go otherwise, but it certainly doesn't have the baggage or the community to defend it that Mars has.
Yes. And this might not be the case in the Western world so much, but in other many other cultures, these kind of mythological things can be more important.
Interesting. We're halfway. Let me take our pause and our break for a couple of minutes, and I'll thank our great sponsors for sponsoring the space show, and I'll be back in about 2 minutes. So just hang on the line, but if you want to step away for tea or coffee or something, go ahead, and it'll take me about 2 minutes to read our sponsor messages. Sponsors, the toll-free line is available, and I will answer it, but I'll put you on hold. So, again, if you would like to call us, 866-687-7223, the same true with email. So, listeners, we do have sponsors, and our great sponsors, they have banner ads running across our homepage, which they can change whenever they want. And they can certainly change what's underneath those banner ads as well. And on the longer format programs, as you know, I read a short message that the sponsors have asked me to read. It's their messages. And on the shorter segment programs, I just shout out to our sponsors and thank them. So we do have some sponsorship spaces available for 2021. Not many, because they do eat into listener talk time and guest talk time, which I reluctantly give up that talk time for sponsors, but we do need the sponsors. So if you're interested, your impression or your print of your message or your company or your belief system or whatever it is you're sponsoring is played on all our archive shows, is not taken away, and as long as space show programs are played, are historically put in a museum or anything like that, your message will be there. So it is long living, to say the least. So Northrop Grumman continues to sponsor us. They are a leading global security company with innovative systems, products, and solutions to government and commercial space. They go from undersea to outer space and cyberspace. And you see many of their projects in the news all the time with rockets and approaches and missions and all sorts of different things that they're pioneering and partnering with others. They're a great company, and we will soon be doing some additional Northrop Grumman guest programs on the space show. The Space Foundation sponsors us, and they have the very famous Space Symposium. It's going to be, as far as I understand it, in Colorado still. It's always in Colorado Springs, but in August, and it'll be a combination of the new one for 2021 and the one that did not happen because of the COVID pandemic last year. And instead of being in March or April, it'll be in August at the Broadmoor Hotel. And networking to die for. You meet all sorts of interesting people. It's very different than a typical space conference. Go to spacesymposium.org for more information. But they have also introduced the Space Symposium 365, which is a digital platform of great content for the space community. You can find out about that at the spacefoundation.org. And also, their outstanding annual industry report, the financial report for the health of the space industry, is being produced quarterly now. And I'm looking forward to some quarterly programs and updates on their really incredible report. So that's the Space Foundation. They're a great organization. Check it all out. And if you want more introduction or more information or introduction to anyone there, please do let me know. Astrox Corporation has been involved with hypersonic space plane and reusable rocket designs for the Air Force, DARPA, and NASA for more than 3 decades. And by the way, hypersonic is back in the news. I'm seeing more and more things about it every week. Their proprietary codes, HiSight and SpaceSight, create and analyze these designs, and they're in the Beltway area of Washington, D.C. Dr. A.J. Kothari is the boss man at Astrox Corporation. He's frequently on the space show, has great ideas for lunar return and lunar settlement. For more information, visit Astrox, Astrox.com. AIAA continues to sponsor us, and this is the world's largest aerospace professional organization. Everything they're doing now is pretty much virtual because of the pandemic, but they usually have 5 conferences and big events a year, and then they have a lot of regional meetings, which could be breakfast, lunch, or dinner meetings. Even that's going virtual now. But it's a great organization. They have decades of peer-reviewed papers that you can access, and their networking is incredible. You meet the people who are actually doing the space things that you read about in the news articles. So check them out at AIAA.org. And Moonwords is a sponsor, and we hear from Kim periodically, and they have a new demo that you can go check out, okay? And I'm looking for their new little message, but all of a sudden I can't find it. My bad, as people like to say. But you can go to moonwords.com. You can download the demo, and you can give it a try. And, you know, it's available on, you know, multiple different formats. Aha, I found it. And I've done it. I don't have a great computer for it, but it's very, very cool. And this is a place where you can build for the future. You download Moontown, as it'll probably be in the late 2000s, and you learn about the technology. You can talk it over with others there. You can move around, and you move around as if you're in or on the moon, I should say. If you have a space project, you can join the community of engineers, programmers, and advocates and help fill the town with detail and life. Display your digital models in the town, animations, audio, slideshows, pop-ups. Seeing is believing, so let's show the world how space can be, and the future is in the making. And then Celestis sponsors us. So with Celestis, this is still the proven Memorial Spaceflight Service. You can go from the Cape Orbital, New Mexico Suborbital. They will be going back to the moon. They've already done one lunar flight. They're going to go back to the moon late next year, I believe is the timeline. Eventually, they'll do in space, maybe Mars. If you want to make the ride with a little bit of the ashes of your loved one or DNA, add your DNA into the mix and you can join them, you know, and sort of make that final ride with the remains of your loved one. And I have done it 3 times with my mom and my dog. I say this all the time. It's really a moving service. I enjoy being a Celestis customer, and it's a great way to memorialize someone who was interested in space. Or can you imagine looking up at the moon and knowing a little bit of your mom or your dad or your spouse or your brother or someone close to you is up there? Or in my case, my mom and 2 dogs. So it's really incredible. So Celestis.com, tell them you heard about them on the space show. The National Space Society sponsors us. They have ISDC. They have the Space Settlement Workshop and Conference. Lots of white papers. Check them out at space.nss.org. They've been having some great virtual programming, and not sure when they're going to be able to resume in person, but I know they're shooting for that. But check out the National Space Society. And those are our sponsors. And as I said, we have room for more, but not many more, because they take up some talk time for our guests. So if you're interested in being a sponsor, get a hold of me by email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we wouldn't be doing the show without our great sponsors, and we thank them very much for their sponsorship. So we're coming into part 2 of our program with Pekka, and we're talking about the possibility of an O'Neillian-type group of cylinders orbiting Sirius. I'll get that right. And it would be a space settlement for all of you interested in space settlement. You might actually ponder that one and want to go there. Your phone number, our phone number, if you would like to give us a call, is 866-687-7223. And email remains drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Pekka, is there any other place other than something like Sirius that is good? So from time to time, someone will be on the program and they'll articulate and advocate about 50 miles up in the Venusian atmosphere. Is pretty Earth-like. That might be a good place for humans to have a settlement. I don't know if you've ever thought about up in the upper atmosphere of Venus in the clouds. Another person who frequently is on the space show, Al Globus, talks about a very low radiation belt around Earth near the equator that would be close enough to Earth and could be a low-cost space settlement sort of training ground for people. I don't know if you're familiar with Al Globus and
yes,
his work.
I am, yes.
What do you think about other options like Venus or the Al Globus orbits?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So concerning Venus, one problem with that is that how to return, if one wants to return. So because the escape velocity of Venus is almost the same as Earth. So if a person who is in that kind of settlement wants to return to Earth, how can he do it? So he would need a rocket which is as big as Starship when launched from, which is equivalent to launching from Earth. And how would that be arranged in Venus?
What do you do?
And
how do you launch
also
a...
where are the raw materials are taken from? So that is the, so because would they be lifted from the surface of Venus, I guess, but it's difficult. So, yeah, so that comes to mind concerning Venus.
I was going to ask you real quick, if you're living in the clouds about 50 miles up, where do you have your spaceport to launch your rocket? Do you have an orbiting spaceport 50 miles up? I mean...
Yes, I mean, that's the thing that I'm wondering. And then also where you take the fuel and oxygen for the rocket if you want to return. Of course, for people who want to go there, this is not needed because, they would need this re-entry shield. But, I mean, but they don't need propellant when settling into the atmosphere. But how to return? So it would be like asymmetrical thing that it's possible to go there, but it's much harder to get out. And that somehow, I like these more symmetrical concepts where you can return as easily as you go there. Okay, then concerning this low Earth orbit, I mean equatorial low Earth orbit colonies, I mean they are certainly viable. And I did some work regarding such colonies, and I was planning to publish it, but then this serious idea came along, and then I preferred that, so I didn't publish. I have some results already for those colonies, but I haven't published them. The main concern there might be the orbital debris. So one needs some kind of orbital debris shielding, and then it's a question of how to minimize the mass of that shielding. And then another consideration is that in order to benefit from this really low radiation environment, the orbit really has to be equatorial plus minus less than 10 degrees. So that means that the launch site, the spaceport, must be essentially at the equator. And currently there is, I guess the French Guiana, the European spaceport, is the only one which is really close to the equator at the moment. And then the third thing is that how to decommission this. I mean, once done with this settlement, how to get rid of it safely. So it will come down by atmospheric drag naturally, but then it should be designed using the so-called designed for demise principle. So it should be designed so that it burns completely in the atmosphere, because otherwise it's kind of dangerous for equatorial countries when it comes down. And this is possible to do, I think, but it has some challenges to design such big facility to be to be designed for demise.
So you go back to your priority or your feeling that the priority really focuses on Ceres, don't you?
Yes, but of course these are not mutually exclusive. So of course everybody understands that low Earth orbit is not a big place. I mean, there is not room for very many settlements. So it could be, if anything, it's a proving ground, a temporary proving ground. And as such, it might be very, very nice to have. So one could test these greenhouse concepts and artificial gravity and space hotel and stuff like that in low Earth orbit, certainly. So I don't think it's excluded in any way. But of course, it doesn't compete with Ceres in long-term settlement, simply because there is not room for that many people in low Earth orbit.
You have a caller on hold. Are you ready to take your first caller? Good morning, caller. Welcome to the program today. Who are you? Where are you? And we appreciate your call.
Hi, David. This is John in Fremont, California.
Okay, go for it.
Yeah, hi Pekka. I'm glad you were able to come on the show. I love this concept. It's really pretty exciting to be able to, have so many O'Neill colonies out there. I was looking at the design, and it requires, it uses sunlight for energy. So you've got these two 45-degree inclined mirrors that reflect sunlight on the array. It's pretty far out. I'm wondering, and those mirrors have to be enormous. Does it make more sense to maybe use nuclear energy for an energy source?
Well, this is a matter of preference, of course. So of course, it's possible to think of other options, such as using nuclear energy or just using solar panels and then having artificial, LED lights inside the colonies, inside the settlements. I selected this natural sunlight in this concept just because I kind of like the idea of natural, because it's more aesthetic to me. So natural lighting. So it has more. It looks better to the eye than artificial lights, in my opinion. But that's just a personal preference. So then concerning nuclear energy, of course, nuclear reactors can produce a lot of heat, but then one has to convert it to electricity. So, and for that one needs some heat engines, which have plenty of moving parts. So it's a kind of I haven't thought about it, but I haven't analyzed this nuclear option. But I mean, it also has its set of reliability issues and stuff like that. Not only the fuel issue.
Yeah, that would complicate it quite a bit. So I like the idea of solar energy as being more aesthetically pleasing. What's it like on the inside? You design these so that they're true O'Neill colonies. So they're like. There are trees and forests and stuff, and
yes,
it's, beautiful inside, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, but the only difference to the original O'Neill colony is that I envisioned the atmosphere to be shallow, so not the whole cylinder is filled by air, but only a 50-meter layer of the atmosphere, and this is to reduce the amount of the volume of air, because there is a limited amount of nitrogen available on Ceres.
Yeah, I like the idea of using the space elevators, and it looks like you've done a lot of work there. So that really improves the efficiency of moving things off of Ceres. Let's see. So this seems to be right down Jeff Bezos' alley. I would think that this would be something that he'd like to maybe support. I mean, his whole philosophy is to move manufacturing off of Earth, and he has a preference over free space settlements over colonies on the Moon or Mars. So. Maybe it'll take a billionaire like Bezos to get this started.
That's just a comment, I guess. Open to assistance regarding this matter, of course. I completely agree. My starting point is always the requirements, that what humans want, what makes humans happy, what makes them thrive, really. What are the biological needs? What are the psychological needs? And I think the 1G gravity is it has such central importance to our physical well-being that it's really hard to ignore, in my opinion. And that kind of leads thinking to this O'Neill, to artificial gravity. That means some kind of spinning, and then it's just a question that where and how you set these spinning settlements, and are they self-contained or free-flying or somehow physically clustered together, like in this, what I call the mega-satellite. And then the other question is that what is the most optimal source body for these materials? And then the third question is that, as you pointed out, that what is the most feasible and most convenient power option? So is it natural sunlight or solar panels and LED lights, or even some form of nuclear power?
Yeah, well, it's a really innovative concept. I liked it a lot. So thanks for coming on the show.
John, would you be interested in going out to one of these settlements and living there?
Absolutely. It would be beautiful inside. And, I think when you think about the economics of it, but I think each cylinder could have its own specialty, and they could trade among each other. And I think there's an economic justification for it, and we just need to work out the details. But there's a ton of reasons for moving things off the Earth and preserving the Earth's environment, and there's a lot of things to do in space, scientifically, economically, and just for entertainment. So I'd love going there.
I think your family would love going there.
No.
I think a lot of people are going to face that one when they want to go to a space settlement, unless it's a short-term visit. But I don't know how Ceres lends itself to a short-term visit, given how far away it is.
Yeah, but you got to realize you're going to a completely new world, and it's going to be beautiful inside. It's not like you're living on the surface of Ceres. You're in an O'Neill colony. And
okay, so
they're gorgeous.
40 years ago, I could go to a Hyatt hotel, and it has a forest and trees and greenery inside, and it's beautiful inside, and high ceilings, 100 feet high, and stuff like that. I remember the Hyatt on the Market Street in downtown San Francisco was that way. So you don't have to go to Ceres to have a beautiful environment inside a structure. So,
all right. Well, you're talking me out of it, David.
So, And if you go to Caesar's Palace, I don't know how old Caesar's Palace is in Las Vegas, but their ceiling is an exact replica of the Las Vegas sky, or maybe it's the Roman sky during Caesar's time. I don't remember, but it rotates according to the time of day. So, like, if you're there at 10 p.m. at night, you're seeing an exact replica of the 10 p.m. at night sky. I mean, it's incredible, and it moves with the time of day. So, and the Forum, which is what it's called, is huge. I mean, you can't walk from one end to the other in probably under 30 minutes. So, I'm just saying that, you know, there's competition if you want really beautiful, cool interior environments, but of course they're clearly not unique and adventuresome like going to Sirius would be really an amazing experience. If you could do it and come back, I guess your minimum travel time, if you wanted to go and come back, what, doctor, do you know the launch windows for getting to Sirius? I mean, could you do it in 3 years like Mars, or would it be a longer period?
I mean, the launch window repeats itself. I mean, it's about 15 months. So it's the launch window occurs more often than for Mars.
Okay, so you might be able, but of course it takes longer.
Because for Mars, it's 26 months, but for Sirius, it's 15 and a half months, if I remember correctly.
So you might be able to come back, except then you have more travel time. So, and you need a good spaceship that's going to protect you from radiation and the other issues for either one of those. So,
yes, I did try to calculate the radiation doses, and it seemed to me that if you would have like 20 or 30 centimeter layer of water around you, then the radiation dose would be moderate, and then, And that water wouldn't cost anything, because that would be the propellant. Also, I mean, but that's assuming that you use electric propulsion, which can use water, and, uh-huh. and you need large solar panel power system to do that, of course.
Okay, John, anything else that you would like to add?
No, that's it. Thank you.
See you on Sirius. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye bye.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Listeners, if you would like to call, and we hope you do, it is toll-free, 866-687-7223, and email remains drspace, drspace, @thespaceshow.com. Do you have a second part to this concept? I mean, are you going to, like, form an organization or do something to try to make it happen, or is it just a theoretical concept and sort of somebody else has to be the driving force behind it if they really want it to happen?
Well, that's a good question. That's the question that I'm trying to answer all the time, so I don't know the answer yet. So, I mean, this is so new concept that I haven't yet been able to think it so thoroughly. I guess both options could be realized. But I'm getting a lot of feedback, lots of contacts all the time. So I have been in tens of interviews and many collaboration proposals already.
So that's what I was going to ask you. What is your feedback like? Is it positive? Do they think you're a nut job? What kind of feedback are you getting?
Yeah, I mean, only positive. I haven't gotten any negative feedback. So I mean, the interviews have been of the normal type,
uh-huh.
That journalists interview, and they mostly ask the same similar questions. And I haven't come across any really criticism. Well, there is one thing was that someone pointed out to me or said that this orbit of 100,000 kilometers, as I was writing in the paper, that would be too high to be stable. So he was saying that something like 65,000 kilometers would be more suitable stable orbit. But this question is under investigation by some of some professional colleagues of mine. I mean, some people who are experts in orbit calculation, because I'm not myself an expert in orbit calculation.
Why do they say...
That's a detail concerning this whole thing.
Right. Why do they say 100,000 is not stable?
Well, he said that he made a simulation and it turned out to be unstable. I don't know. I mean, that the solar tidal forces from the sun and the rest of the solar system would somehow disturb the orbit. Yes.
Linda is in Phoenix, Arizona, with an email. And Linda says, I've heard from many others, and when David used to do programs about the Dawn mission when it was in play, there was always talk about Ceres as a place for settlement, although pretty far out in the future. Do you think there might be anything like artifacts in and around Ceres from previous civilizations or societies that maybe had similar ideas to what you have? For example, I recently heard Professor Avi Loeb talk about why he thinks that the fast-moving interstellar object Oumuamua might have extraterrestrial origins to it. Could something like Ceres have some kind of extraterrestrial artifacts from who knows when?
Okay, so obviously we don't know. Simply, we must admit that we don't know. So the best thing to do is just to keep the eyes open in case something unexpected happens. Of course, in theory, in principle, everything like that is in principle possible. But how likely, that is another question.
Do you think it's likely or probably not?
And well, probably not. But I mean. Probably not. I mean,
it wouldn't be a trend.
I would think that if there are other civilizations in this universe, in this galaxy, it's clear that if there are long-lived technical civilizations other than us, then they are much older than us. I mean, just from the statistical point of view. Because we are extremely young, so we just invented the steam engine a couple of hundreds of years ago, and that's just a blink of an eye in the galactic timescale. So, if there are other civilizations, they are much more evolved technically than us, and then I would think that they would not apply technologies such as this fast-moving body, but. That they would be something more advanced than that. That would be my guess. But of course, I don't know anything about that.
You have another email from Ben in Omaha, Nebraska. And Ben says the Dawn mission was a NASA government project. And, of course, it had other places to go other than just Ceres. But do you think that a private company, SpaceX, or maybe Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos' company, or any company could actually fund and put together a mission to go to Ceres? Is it plausible for a commercial company to do that?
Yes, certainly it's plausible. I mean, given the effort that is already being put to by these companies to launch our business and to Mars settlement things and lunar things. I mean, certainly it's possible, yes.
Do you think we'll see this? Let me phrase it this way. We talk about a Mars timeline of maybe in the early to mid 2030s or something like that.
Mm.
Is a Ceres mission competitive with that timeline if it were done by a commercial company?
I think that Ceres is roughly equally challenging as building a settlement on Mars. I mean, it has certain benefits and certain drawbacks, but roughly speaking, they might balance out each other approximately. But of course, Ceres is a new thing, so therefore Mars already has a lead. I mean, many people have already thought about Mars settlement, and the plans are already somewhat mature, while the Ceres plan is just now starting. So from that point of view, maybe put some extra years before Ceres can happen. Well, I mean, relative to Mars, but that's just for prudence sake. I mean, to be conservative. I mean, it's very hard to predict these things because everything is possible if there is enough effort to do it, basically, in these kind of things. But if there is no effort, then certainly nothing happens. And effort means investment also, so not only enthusiasm, but also investment of at least a few billions.
And have you, I sort of asked this to you a little earlier, are you aware of any movement starting to make this happen? I know I asked you about your efforts, but has anyone in the feedback talked to you about, starting to some kind of an infrastructure or some kind of a project? Maybe a company's come to you, or maybe like what sprung up for going to Mars to try to make some of this happen. I mean, we hear.
This has been also part of the feedback that I have gotten. Yes.
So there are people that are interested in starting to work on something.
Yes.
Like
yes.
This.
At least according to those.
Well, I'd love to talk.
At least if I trust those people who contacted me regarding that. Yes.
Well, I'd love to talk to them on the space show. I think. Yeah, I'd love to talk to people.
I don't want to disclose this information.
No, I understand
right
that.
Because these discussions are of course confidential up to now. So,
but maybe some.
But
of them
I can just in general terms, I can say that such discussions have been, or such things have been mentioned in private discussions. Yes.
Well, if any of them listen to this show or listen on our archives, and you want to talk about this. Email me. I'd love to put you on the space show and do a program about this type of space settlement. Have you been in touch with the National Space Society here in the United States that does the space settlement workshop and conference? Are you familiar with them? And
Yes, I have been. Well, I have been in touch with Al Globus, and
okay.
He also checked the paper. I mean, gave comments of this paper, and I kind of iterated the paper with him before submitting it to this JBS journal. Yes. So actually, Al is also mentioned in the acknowledgments of this paper. Yes.
Well, it would be fun to see this develop into a real effort like Mars. Is there a role that I think policy plays an important part in something like this? So is there a role for space enthusiasts, for advocates, to help make something like this move to more of a priority stage? Do you see a role of supporters rather than maybe the people who can directly contribute or who might want to go there?
Yes, of course. I mean, this kind of support, indirect support, is certainly part of the equation if we want to make this, in order to make this happen. Yes. Not only money and not only workforce, but also this kind of enthusiasm is of course essential.
Alice is in the Washington D.C. area, and she says, "Have you thought about, or are you planning to maybe write a book based on a series settlement, or do you know if anyone is planning to do that?"
I haven't yet thought that far, but I mean, it might be a good idea. I have just finished writing a popular science book about astrobiology in my native language, Finnish, which will come out in a couple of months. I mean, together with some other co-authors. So thanks for the idea.
Will your book be translated and available outside of Finland? Will it be in English too down the road?
Well, not at the moment. But there is such option has, I mean, in the contract that we have with the publisher, there is an option of doing that kind of translation if there is some need. And I have actually received some. Some indications that there might be interest also in the English language community to read that kind of book. Yes.
Alan is in Dallas, Texas, and listeners, there's still time. If you want to get a quick phone call in for us, we would certainly welcome that, and we can probably get maybe one or two more emails in. We'll see. The phone number again, 866-687-7223, and the email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Alan is in Houston, Texas, Dallas, Texas. I've got a brother named Alan in Houston. That's what I was thinking of. But this Alan is in Dallas, and he says, have you floated this by NASA? Have you gotten any official or semi-official feedback or interest in any of this from NASA?
No, and I haven't even had time to try yet. So I have been, after this went public, I have been rather busy just answering in interviews and contacts. So I mean, this thing is still in the future. Yes.
To start out with, you need. You're going to have missions taking supplies there to build the cylinders because you're not going to be set up to immediately get resources from Sirius, right? So
yes.
How many?
Yes, that is right.
So how many I don't know the right terminology, but how many pre-launches or flights do you need in order to get going so that you are at a point where you can start using local resources?
Yes, this is a very good question. I can't give you an answer right now because this hasn't been, I haven't analyzed this question yet. So, but I mean, I would imagine, I mean, the answer depends very much on the requirements of humans. And for example, the parameter that what is the minimum rotation radius in terms of artificial gravity which is possible for people without inducing this motion sickness.
Right.
So that is a key parameter because that defines the scale of the smallest viable cylindrical settlement. And of course, one way to get this information would be to make an experiment in low Earth orbit with just two masses connected to each other by a tether, and then just spin the system. So that would be kind of a much lower cost way of getting that information besides going to Ceres or other places in the solar system.
Boy, people have been calling for that for as long as I can remember. We're still not seeing those kinds of experiments. It's unfortunate. What's next for you? Are you writing more on this subject? Are you going to be publishing a different paper? What is next on your horizon?
I need to go into the. I need to look into the steel factory concept at least. At what is the minimum size of a steel factory for making structural materials? So that is one thing. And then, actually, trying to answer the last question that you asked me just 1 minute ago, that's another priority. So what is the minimum viable settlement in order to get estimate of the initial cost? And then also expanding this sphere of people who are involved. So I today already had some, for example, I had some meeting with some architects who were interested in this, and we discussed how to, from the architectural point of view, the interior design and stuff like that. So that kind of things.
We're pretty much at the end of the program. Have we missed something that you wanted to tell us about or share with us? Have we overlooked something, or do you want to add anything to the discussion?
No, I would just like to say regarding COVID situation that that better times are rather nearby, so everybody just keep up the fighting spirit and stay healthy and don't give up yet, so because the vaccines are already here and they will be distributed.
That's right. If we get
sooner or later.
If we get the series, we probably won't even need the vaccine. We'll have better times up there, I would imagine, right?
Well, I'm pretty sure that the vaccines will arrive earlier than that.
I appreciate your coming back on, and I love your thinking and your work, and I look forward to talking to you again down the road. So, and hopefully we'll get that opportunity. And it's a great project, and I love to continue to follow and see how it develops. And I'm glad the space show can do at least a little bit by getting the word out. And I will put the links to the paper in my summary and on the blog. And, you know, can people contact you, or do you want them to go through me? Can I give out your email address to people?
Yeah, yes, of course, yes.
Okay. And listeners, he has a website address, which is electric-sailing.fi. So you can go to
that website has yet it doesn't have any material up
here.
Okay,
so that's okay.
Because so, you know this thing went public without my planning. So the paper is still a preprint. It's not officially published. So I wasn't prepared yet to this publicity at all. So I'm just now trying to make some presentation material regarding this concept.
Okay.
But it will appear at some point
on
some website.
So listeners, check the website from time to time. It'll be coming to life, but I'll put it in the archive summary of the program too. Pekka, thank you very much for being with us, and I'm already looking forward to our next conversation with you, and I hope it's soon, and good luck with the progress of what you're doing, and it's exciting, and we're glad that you're a space show guest and friend, and stay well and healthy, and we look forward to a lot more from you over the coming months and even later this year, okay?
Okay, yeah, thank you, David. It's always a pleasure to be included in this show.
And I will send you the show and the archive information probably by tomorrow morning my time. And we'll talk again in the near future. So once again, stay well and healthy.
Okay.
Listeners, thank you for your emails. John, thank you for your call. Everybody have a good, safe weekend, and don't do crazy things, and keep your health together. And as always, keep looking up. Goodbye from Pekka, David, and The Space Show.